consider it possible that the Western democracies would permit the annexation of Austria by Hitler, because that obviously would be the first phase in a series of events that would culminate in a world war. The occupation of Austria would create a strategic situation that would make possible the conquest of Czechoslovakia, and the conquest of Czechoslovakia would consolidate a central European position that made war with the Western powers simply victorious. It was my great surprise that the Western powers did nothing. From a friend who was at the time working in Rome and had friends in the Italian foreign ministry, I learned that in the night of the invasion, Mussolini was engaged in frantic telephone conversations with the English government for a common action, which however was rejected by England. I remember the events as causing a sort of unlimited fury. In the wake of the Austrian occupation by Hitler, I contemplated even for a moment to join the National Socialists, because these rotten swines who called themselves democrats, meaning the Western democracies, were certainly worse to be conquered if they would permit such idiocies. But the character development of the past could not be erased overnight.
Certainly deserved to be conquered.
Yeah. Deserved. Conquered, deserved to be conquered and destroyed.
Said worth to be conquered.
But reason got the better after several hours of such fury. And I prepared my emigration. That was necessary because I had never made any secret of my anti-national socialist attitude, and of course was immediately fired from my position in the university. The preparation of the emigration had all sorts of the usual odd details which are connected with such an enterprise. I had to acquire some money outside Austria because the export of money was prohibited. And I had a Swiss friend who was a journalist in Vienna reporting for Swiss newspapers, with whom I arranged for paying for his income in Austria while he would leave the countervalue in Swiss francs with his lawyer in Zurich. The money accumulated with the lawyer in Zurich became then the base for living a number of months in Zurich before I could get my American immigration visa from the consulate in Zurich. The immigration plan almost miscarried. Though I was politically an entirely unimportant figure, and the important ones had to be caught first, the turn came to me at last. And just when we had about finished our preparation, and my passport was already with the police in order to get the exit visa, the Gestapo appeared in my apartment in order to confiscate the passport. Fortunately, I was not at home, and my wife was delighted to tell them that the passport was with the police for the purpose of getting the exit visa, which satisfied the Gestapo, and we were able, through friends, to get the passport, including the exit visa, out of the police before the Gestapo got it. That was all on the same day, and on the same day in the evening, with two bags, I caught a train to Zurich, trembling on the way that the Gestapo, after all, would find out about me and arrest me at the border. But apparently even the Gestapo was not as efficient as my wife and I in these matters. And I got through unmolested, unarrested. My wife stayed with her parents, with a Gestapo guard in front of the apartment, waiting that I should return. And she knew that I had escaped, because the Gestapo guard was withdrawn, and about 20 minutes later my telegram arrived from Zurich that I had arrived there. But that was only the beginning of odd events. In Zurich I had to wait for a non-quota immigration visa extended to scholars who would get a job in the United States. And my friends in Harvard, Haberler, Schumpeter, and in a very decisive function as head of the department, Arthur Holcomb, had provided a part-time instructorship in Harvard, but they had not received yet the official letter. And they had to wait for that in Zurich before I got the American visa. In waiting for that, I had dealings with the vice consul in Zurich, a very nice Harvard boy, who looked at me with grave suspicion. He explained to me that I was neither a communist, nor a Catholic, nor a Jew, and therefore had no reason whatsoever to be not in favor of this National Socialist, and be a National Socialist myself. Hence, if I was obviously in flight, the only reason could be some criminal involvement, and he did not want to give me a visa before the matter of my criminality was cleared up. Fortunately, in due course, the letter from Holcomb arrived, advising me of my appointment as a part-time instructor in Harvard. And with the signature of Holcomb on the letter, the Harvard boy who was vice consul was convinced that I was in the fold, and I got my visa. I'm reporting that not in order to be critical of this particular vice consul, who was as innocent of political problems, and especially human problems, as such people happen to be. And I want to give another example of the same kind, which occurred 30 years later in the 1960s. When I was at some meeting in a symposium of lectures, of which I had to give one, in Salzburg, there was an interesting scene. Among the other lecturers in Salzburg was Ernst Bloch, the Marxist philosopher. And the wives were there too. Mrs. Bloch was there and my wife. At some dinner, the ladies got into talking, and Mrs. Bloch inquired cautiously why we hadn't been in America too, because after all, we were not Jews. And she asked whether I had been a communist. And my wife explained, no, I hadn't been a communist either. Whereupon she asked, well, then why couldn't I stay in Austria? That anybody could be international socialist without motivated by an ideological counterposition or under the necessity of being a Jew is indeed, as far as my experience goes, inconceivable to most people in the academic world whom I know.
This is the beginning of session 5, June 29th, 1973.
Concerning the year in France. After the 2 years in America, the Rockefeller Foundation was kind enough to extend to Laura Spelman Rockefeller Memorial Fellowship for another year to continue my studies in France. The general idea of doing that was to enlarge my horizon by living in France and finding out firsthand what relevant points in French culture were for a political scientist. The field for studies was wide open. I attended courses in the law school, especially with a French economist whose name at the moment I have forgotten, and I attended the lectures of the famous Brunswick. In the beginning, my studies were somewhat hampered because I had a reading knowledge of French, but not a really good knowledge of more complicated vocabulary. I remember going into French literature, which I knew still very imperfectly at the time, and in reading the Trois Contes by Flaubert. That was quite an ordeal, because Flaubert's vocabulary is enormous, and I had to use a dictionary practically in every sentence. But this happens to be the only way of building up the vocabulary of a language, that is by reading authors who have the vocabulary. There was, at the time, an irresistible attraction in Paris. That is, the flood of Russian refugees. I happened to get acquainted with quite a few of them and understood the necessity of learning Russian, after all, in order to have access to the political materials. Hence, I started learning Russian with Mochulsky and Losinsky as teachers. This work on learning Russian continued practically through the whole year, and I got far enough to be able to read Dostoevsky. Unfortunately, I have forgotten most of the Russian because, in the practice of my work, I had later too little occasion to deal with Russian sources. But the main area of studies, of course, was French literature and philosophy. Good guide for introducing myself into the problems were the work of Thibaudet on Mallarmé and Valéry, and the work by René Laloux on the history of French literature in general, and on the history of the novel in particular. I acquired in this year in Paris a practically complete set of the important French prose literature from the Princesse de Clèves of the Madame de Lafayette to the work of Marcel Proust, whose last volumes of the Recherche du Temps Perdu were coming out at the time. Again, Marcel Proust, like Flaubert, was an inestimable source for enriching my French vocabulary. René Laloux's work de Descartes à Proust was of fundamental importance for my understanding the continuity of French intellectual history, because here I found the parallels in the treatment of a philosophy of consciousness to my studies which I had conducted in America on the development of consciousness in English and American philosophy from the 18th century to the present. Through both Thibaudet and Laloux, my attention was directed especially to Mallarmé and Valéry. At this time, I assembled my almost complete collection of the works of Paul Valéry, several of them in first editions, which now have become valuable. I had occasion to see Paul Valéry once when he gave an after-dinner talk at some meeting connected with the League of Nations. What interested me most about Valéry at the time, besides the fact that he was a great artist, was his Lucretian philosophy, which I understood as a parallel phenomenon to the Lucretianism of George Santayana. The poem with which I fell in love particularly was the Cimetière Marin. The opportunity of spending a year in Paris, of course, was also used, as far as the means permitted, to see the surroundings. I remember the first great impression of Chartres and the trip in summer to the remnants of the cathedrals and monasteries in Normandy. In the background, of course, were my studies in the French theory of law, especially of Dugy and name to be remembered.
Dugit.
At that time, I got my first acquaintance with the French problem of the solidarité. Curiously enough, I was not yet attracted to the work of Henri Bergson, though I was already familiar with his Matière et Mémoire and his Données immédiates de la conscience. My real interest in Bergson only grew with the publication of his De sources de la morale et de la religion in 1934. A special area of interest became the French memoir literature. I remember reading with fascination the memoirs of the Cardinal de Retz. They gave me an introduction to the politics of the 17th century. Perhaps because of their size, the memoirs of Saint-Simon did interest me somewhat less. The Retz memoirs were to me especially important as describing one of the great conspiracies that was characteristic of the 17th century. I studied the parallels in the case of the Wallenstein conspiracy, of the conspiracy of the Fiesco in Genoa, and of the conspiracy of the Spaniards in Venice. One of the memoirs I read at the time were those of the Duc de la Rochefoucauld, and that gave me the transition to the philosophy of the moralist. I read with care at the time, in addition to La Rochefoucauld, Wovenaar, and found out about the line of influence that goes from the French moralist to Nietzsche. I was again in Paris in 1934 for several weeks of work in the Bibliothèque Nationale. At this time I was interested in the French 16th century and especially the work of Jean Bodin. At that time I collected my materials for a comprehensive study of Bodin's work, which in fact later was written down for the purpose of the History of Ideas, but never published. In working on Bodin, I worked through the French in the Bibliothèque Nationale for the French publications in politics and history in the 16th century.